I'm going to call this meeting of the House Early Childhood and Family Support Committee for Tuesday, April 4th, 2017 to order. And I'm going to open two public hearings, one on House Bill 3314 and House Bill 3367. And we'll start with Zena reading the information.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, House Bill 3314 establishes the Oregon Bright Futures Fund in the state treasury. There is a dash one amendment that replaces the measure. It establishes an Oregon Bright Futures Fund in the state treasury for post-secondary education savings program. It establishes a financial institution community education subaccount. It authorizes the state registrar of the Center for Health Statistics to send data, a data file on children born in Oregon to DCBS. It directs DCBS to open a designated beneficiary account of participating financial institutions for each child and to establish a maximum amount in the account. It authorizes DCBS to use monies in the fund for post-secondary education expenses and provide scholarships, grants, and incentives to designated beneficiaries. It allows contributions by designated beneficiaries or by DCBS into the account. It allows donations or contributions into the fund. There is a dash two amendment which clarifies provisions related to disclosure of confidential information. There may have a fiscal impact, but no statement is issued and no revenue impact has been issued. House Bill 3367 creates the Oregon Bright Future Savings Fund in the state treasury. There is a dash one amendment that replaces the measure. It appropriates funds out of the general fund to DCBS to be used on the savings program for post-secondary education expenses. There may be a fiscal impact, but no statement has been issued, and there may be a revenue impact, but no statement has been issued.
Okay, thank you. So, Representative Bueller, Representative Power, and Representative Bynum, please. And I know I don't have to remind your representatives, but since I screwed up yesterday in judiciary and never bothered to introduce myself, you do have to introduce yourself for the record. The chair was kind enough to look the other way, but
I'll make sure I do that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Lively. Thanks for the reminder to introduce myself. My name is Newt Bueller. I represent House District 54, which is most of the city of Bend. And thank you for the time. And I'm going to be very brief because there's lots of people here who should be very excited about this bill and are. And it's really a culmination of over a year's of work, of hard work from lots of people. And I just want to call out some by name. Janet and Jill at Neighborhood Partners, thank you very much. My Chief of Staff, Jordan Conger, who is really been intimately involved in putting together a lot of the details of this bill, and as you'll see as we get going, it is a relatively complex, simple concept, but complex in implementation. I'd like to thank my co-sponsors, not only Senator Roblin, but also Representative Bynum and Power. Thank you guys for helping out. A big thank you to DCBS because there's a lot of technical details that they'll need to help us with implementation. They've been very open and receptive to that, and certainly also our partners in the private sector, the Oregon Bankers Association, and the credit unions in Oregon, all have been very willing to help out. What this bill does, 3314, is really the core concept, and what it does is it really moves beyond just complaining about things, that things aren't good enough in the state, especially with regards to our young people in terms of the results that we're seeing in our schools, and really is a clear bet on kids. It sends a clear message that every kid is valued and every kid has a potential. And in other states where this approach has been used, or I should say other cities, you see enormous positive results. And it changes almost the psychology. When you invest in kids, it changes the mindset. So when kids have even as little as $500 put into one of these child savings accounts, they're much more likely to graduate from high school and much more likely once they go to college to actually finish college training. But these funds can also also be used not only for college education, but also vocational training, as you'll see people talk about it. And this really will require a team effort to implement and get this up and going, and I think we have assembled a strong team, not only within DCBS, but also within a financial institution in the state of Oregon. But the bottom line is what this plan will do. Will really make kids see that people believe in them, start making them think that they can have a future after high school, come up with that kind of a plan, and that it's worthy to invest in them. So I think it's time to be bold. It's not enough just to talk about the problems that our young people are facing in Oregon. It's time to start solving some of the problems, and I think this goes at least a good portion of the way in vetting on our kids in Oregon. So thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you. Next.
Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Karin Power. I represent Milwaukee, Oak Grove, and parts of Southeast Portland. I'm speaking in support of House Bill 3314 and House Bill 3367 that would create bright futures for Oregon children by way of creating a new form of children's savings accounts with DCBS. Thank you. We know that when families talk about education with their kids, children have better outcomes. Having just $100 in savings for higher education would be the difference in a child feeling motivated to do better versus them feeling like college or vocational training is out of reach. Economic factors are not firmly within our control in this building, but the policies that might influence these factors are within our purview. An unexpected financial challenge might wipe out a family's savings, savings that may have been intended for future educational costs, but it may instead be tapped for medical costs or other household needs. Currently, we have a few different savings account options in Oregon, like the 529 plan. These current options do not meet the needs of all parents and guardians, though. We need savings mechanisms that work for the families for whom 529 investment accounts are out of reach. Through this bill, we have worked closely to design, from the ground up, a plan that will reach kids least likely to be reached by current mechanisms and ensure those savings will be there when the child needs them down the road. We don't currently have a savings mechanism that reaches low and moderate income kids. This is an exciting opportunity, and I'll let others say more on it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Lively and members of the committee. My name is Janelle Bynum, and I am the state representative for the Great House District 51 in Oregon. So today I'm here to testify in support of House Bills 3314 and 3367. Because I believe the concept of helping families build generational wealth is extremely important, and we have a chance today to help them do so. Many families in my community, as well as around Oregon, experience a barrier to entry for savings when they have so many other things going on in their lives. Whether it's various backgrounds and cultural differences, sometimes it makes having meaningful savings accounts seem out of reach. With these bills, we'd create a brick-and-mortar option that families can easily access and track. And I think promoting the habit of saving for the next generation will help more families plan for their future and their children's educations. I firmly believe that families should have multiple on-ramps to savings for college. Some would ask, why should we have, you know, more than just the 529 plan? We already have that. But I would point them to one really good example that works for me. And I point you to the example of life insurance. Some people use it to provide a financial cushion when a loved one dies. Other people use it to provide an inheritance. And then other people use it to provide income for taxes, to pay the taxes for an estate. And you can obtain life insurance at work, through an agent, online, at a bank, multiple places. It's one product, has different uses, and multiple access points. Well, for HB 3314 and HB 3367, we could apply the same concept to savings accounts, and I think that you should join me in supporting them. It's important for multiple access points to be available to families to help save for their children's educations, and as Representatives Bueller and Power noted, not one option fits every family's needs, and so these are 3314 provides us with that option. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any members have any questions? Thank you very much for bringing the bill and for your testimony. I'm going to call up Melissa Hicks and Jill Windsor, and we're going to get Rebecca Loy on the phone. Hi, Rebecca. This is John Lively with the Early Childhood Family Supports Committee. We're just starting the hearing on the House Bill 3314, and Jill is up front. And so I don't know, did you want Melissa to go first and then? Okay. So we'll have Melissa, and then we'll bring you on to go through the slides. So thank you.
Sounds great. Thank you.
You bet.
Good afternoon, Chair Light, members of the committee. My name is Melissa Hicks, and I work at Self Enhancement Inc. in Northeast Portland. I also serve as the co-chair of the Oregon Asset Building Coalition. I am here today to ask for your support of House Bills 3314 and 3367. Self Enhancement works to support the success of youth in our community. For those of you not familiar with our work, I've provided some background with my submitted testimony. As a culturally specific organization that primarily serves the African American community, we have a long track record of success in spite of the challenges that kids in our community face. We see children's savings accounts, like what is proposed as the Oregon Bright Futures Plan, as a powerful new tool that we could use to have even more impact with the children and families we serve. Children's savings accounts, as you will hear from our next witness, are a proven, exciting tool. They're good for kids, good for parents, and good for our communities. We at Self Enhancement see many possibilities to incorporate them into our work and are very excited by the impacts they promise. CSAs are a tool for our families that are most impacted by financial barriers to attending post-secondary education. I believe CSAs will instill two things that our community desperately needs: an increase in financial healthy habits and a developed sense of college identity early at a young age. Most exciting from our perspective is that as a community with unique strengths and unique challenges, we will be able to use the Oregon Bright Futures Plan in ways that work for us. It's both universal, every child in Oregon will have a Bright Future account, and it's adaptable so that it will work to support our kids and families. I'm going to turn this over now to Rebecca Loya of the Institute of Assets and Social Policy at Brandeis, and then Jill Windsor of Neighborhood Partnerships will provide additional details on the bill.
Okay, thank you. So, Rebecca, if you just introduce yourself for the record, please.
Sure, yes. So my name is Rebecca Loya, and I'm a senior research associate at the Institute on Assets and Social Policy at Brandeis University. I did submit some slides. I'm not sure if you are able to see them now.
Yes, we've got them up.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So I am here today to share the compelling research findings on children's savings accounts in support of the Oregon Bright Futures Plan. Research suggests that the value of CSAs goes well beyond what families' saved dollars can afford. And the benefit of CSAs are especially powerful for children from low and moderate income families. Please note that I'll use the term college today to refer to the range of post-secondary pursuits in education. Next slide, please. So the first point is that CSAs improve children's development and educational expectations. CSAs begin benefiting children at a very young age. Infants with family incomes under 200% of the federal poverty line who receive CSAs have greater social emotional development at age 4 than those without CSAs. The accounts also appear to reduce rates of depressive symptoms among mothers. CSAs also boost parents and children's academic expectations starting in early childhood. These effects matter because parents and children's educational expectations are powerful predictors of young people's later academic achievement. In other words, kids who do not think of college as an option are much less likely to end up in college. One way that CSAs can shift kids' trajectory is by encouraging children and parents to think of post-secondary education as a real possibility. Next slide, please. The second point I want to make is that CSAs improve children's academic performance and their college access. Children with CSAs show measurable gains in academic performance. For instance, having dedicated college savings is associated with higher math and reading scores. Children with even small amounts of educational savings, so this is up to $500, are more than 2.5 times more likely to enroll in and complete college. And these effects are even stronger for children from low and moderate income families, who are 3 times more likely to attend college and more than 4 times more likely to graduate from college if they have just some modest educational savings. Next slide, please. Third, CSAs can be intentionally designed to benefit lower income families. So as many of the folks in the room probably know, current college savings platforms like 529 plans and Cloverdale accounts disproportionately benefit those with greater wealth, which in turn exacerbates inequalities over generations. In recent years, many states have created CSA programs that simply offer incentives like matching grants for low and moderate income families to save in 529 accounts. However, low-income families still face many barriers to opening these accounts, including complex application forms, initial deposit requirements, fees, and other barriers. Despite growing outreach to lower-income families, the median income of families with 529s or Cloverdales remains about 3 times that of families without these accounts. This illustrates a critical point. Despite their overall promise, CSAs could actually exacerbate economic inequalities if they fail to facilitate meaningful access for lower-income families. Next slide. So how can CSAs be accessible for lower-income families? The research is clear on this point. The most effective way to achieve widespread participation in CSAs is to automatically enroll all children in the catchment area, which is known as a universal opt-out approach. Maine's CSA, which is called the Harold Alphonse College Challenge, I'll call it HAC, is a valuable case study. From 2009 to 2012, HAC offered $500 to parents of all newborns in the state, but enrollment was not automatic, and only about 40% of parents enrolled their newborns. Parents with higher income, higher education, and other investments were more likely to participate in the CSA. In 2013, HAC switched to an opt-out model, and participation rates jumped from 40% to 100%. And importantly, automation eliminated the inequalities in account ownership. Next slide, please. Other features that help CSAs to meaningfully include all families are offering a savings match and other incentives, partnering with community organizations for outreach, utilizing account structures that are familiar to families at local financial institutions, and accepting deposits in a variety of formats, including in person and in cash. Inclusive CSAs also offer an opportunity for financial literacy education for the whole family and improve parents' access to regulated financial institutions and credit. So in closing, CSAs are a powerful tool to improve educational outcomes for children, and they're particularly powerful for children from low-income families. With benefits spanning from the cradle to retirement, the Oregon Bright Futures Plan is a promising approach for Oregon's children. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thanks a lot, Rebecca.
Is she staying on the phone?
Yeah, do you want to stay on the phone or?
Question?
You have a question? I think Representative Kenny
Geyer. I will stay if there are questions.
Sure.
Yes.
I think Representative Kenny Geyer has a question.
Thank you. I just wanted to go to the research, and I know you have a long list of footnotes, so I'll try to find some of the ones around issues that are of particular interest to me. But I wonder if off the cuff you could tell us. When the earliest one went into effect, because I don't know if there's some that go back before 2009, and what some of the specific data shows you, particularly for low-income families, about ones that had access to this versus ones that didn't, in terms of their going on to secondary education, first of all. And then, secondly, was there a threshold in the amount of money in their account that made a difference? Because 500 is very different from 25 in this model here.
Sure. So to answer your question, the history of CSAs does stretch all the way back to 1997. That's the first time a matching grant was offered on a 529 plan. But the program that you'd probably be most interested in is the SEED demonstration, which started in 2003. There was one experiment done in Oklahoma that actually used an experimental design and looked at kids who were enrolled in a program automatically compared to a control group. And a number of the findings that I've spoken about today have been, at least the preliminary metrics have been demonstrated for the kids in that experiment. However, as you might guess, the children who were enrolled at birth in 2003 are just getting to the age where we'll be able to look at college outcomes for them. So those findings are not conclusive yet. However, I did point out in the slide that there are some really powerful and interesting effects for children from low and moderate income families who have savings, who are more than 4.5 times more likely to graduate from college if they have any amount of savings from $1 to $499. And then children with school savings greater than $500 are 5 times more likely to graduate using these data from the panel study on income dynamics.
And what was the first, before the 5 times, what was the other times?
4.5 times more likely.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Rebecca? Doesn't look like it. Thanks again, Rebecca, for taking the time to call in.
My pleasure.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So, Jill?
Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Chair Lively, members of the committee, my name is Jill Windsor. I'm the Financial Innovations Director at Neighborhood Partnerships, and I staff the Oregon Asset Building Coalition. Thank you for allowing me the time to present to you all today. We believe that all children in Oregon should be encouraged to dream big and to plan for their future. The Oregon Bright Futures Plan is a children's savings account platform that encourages families to start planning for post-high school opportunities as soon as their children are born. My task here today is to walk you through the bills, and I'll start with House Bill 3314. So with the DASH amendments, House Bill 3314 will authorize the Department of Consumer and Business Services, DCBS, to develop the Oregon Bright Futures Plan, a children's savings account platform, to launch as soon as January 1 of 2018. The bill creates the Oregon Bright Futures Fund. The fund will be a mix of grants, contributions, or state appropriations. The bill requires that on a quarterly basis, the Center for Health Statistics will provide DCBS with information about each child born in Oregon. And you'll see testimony in OLIS from Oregon Health Authority indicating their ability to provide that information. Once money is available, either from state appropriation or from grants or contributions received, DCBS will design the Bright Futures Plan rule. That will include developing an account structure for the Oregon Bright Futures accounts to be held at Oregon banks and credit unions, which voluntarily elect to participate. Managing a request for proposals process to identify financial institution partners who want to hold those accounts. And if needed, conducting an RFP process to select a technology platform provider. And that would be an off-the-shelf product that would link Oregon Bright Futures accounts to community-based incentive programs, facilitating that process. House Bill 3367 with the DASH 1 amendments will prompt a discussion of possible general fund contributions to DCBS to allow for a small dollar seed payment into each child's Bright Futures account. We're hoping for about $25. Once the program is designed, implementation of the Oregon Bright Futures Plan will launch. DCBS will communicate with mothers, allowing them to choose which financial institution will hold their account and explaining how they can start to save in those accounts. DCBS will open a Bright Futures account for each child within the pilot area. Pilots will test the impact of program design features on participation, engagement, and behavior. DCBS will work to determine the best way to scale the program statewide, really keeping an eye to minimize state costs, the cost for financial institutions, and for community partners. Community institutions and partners will be recruited to provide grants or incentives to children or to support family engagement. And in the written testimony I submitted via OLIS, you'll see that we've laid out our goals and metrics for the implementation phase, but I wanted to highlight a couple of things here. Most importantly, we want to make sure that all children in Oregon, each and every child, know that we're expecting big things of them. And that's why we've designed an opt-out universal program. We want to reach children that are the least likely to have savings set aside for post-secondary education. And to that point, ensuring that children from families with limited means can imagine a brighter future requires that we facilitate the support of community partners and the organizations they trust. When those trusted community partners are able to wrap around families and support their engagement in the platform, We'll see the changes in attitudes, hopes, and expectations that will lead to a brighter future. Allowing local community-based organizations, funders, and others to develop incentive and scholarship programs means that we are able to target resources where they are most needed. We've been in contact with foundations and other partners who have indicated strong interest in this kind of investment once legislative support is evident. When fully funded, the Oregon Bright Futures Plan will open accounts for each Oregon child at birth. That's about 45,000 children a year. We hope to open between 5,000 and 10,000 accounts during the pilot phase. In the year 2020, the legislature will hear a report on family participation and engagement in the Oregon Bright Futures Plan. We hope you will support this effort to bring communities together in new ways to create a brighter future for Oregon's children. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions for any of these members?
I'm going to have some technical questions, and I don't know if you're the best one to ask maybe at the end of this panel or if other people are
coming
up.
There's some people here from DCBS to answer technical
questions.
Yeah,
but some of them have to do with this compared to 529 compared to IDA. So you might be the best person to answer some of those questions.
Absolutely, and Quinn Collins is prepared to take questions and to pull me back up as needed, so we can wait till the end, or I'm happy to take questions now, whichever works.
Okay. Thank you very much. Next up is Cara Thompson, Tim Martinez, and Pam Levitt.
Hello, I'm Kara Thompson of Columbia Bank. I serve as Chief Compliance Officer and have been involved with neighborhood partnerships through a technical advisory committee, and now I serve on the Board of Directors. I am honored to say that Columbia Bank is looking forward to supporting this initiative. Columbia Bank hopes to participate in the pilot that may take place. We absolutely believe that this is the right thing for community banks to be doing in our communities. Certainly, this is one way in which community banks can demonstrate effort with their regulators relative to the Community Reinvestment Act. Aspects of this bill have discussed the opportunity to form a fund that community banks can specifically designate investments into for the benefit of low to moderate income children. We are absolutely stunned by the metrics that were shared by Rebecca and other studies that we have reviewed since an involvement in this particular pilot. We see that this is perhaps one of the most exciting initiatives that we will have been involved with in our Community Reinvestment Act initiatives.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Hey, Tim, you're up.
Hi, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for scheduling this bill, and thank you to the proponents of the bill for bringing it forward. And a special thank you to both Columbia Bank and Umpqua Bank for providing folks that have really taken this issue to heart and have spent a lot of hours preparing what you have before you. The Bankers Association supports the bill. As you can imagine, there are a lot of details to work out. And we look forward to continuing our involvement with this issue and working with the DCBS and others once the bill is signed into law to get something that works for all. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Tim.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively and members of the committee. Pam Levitt representing the Northwest Credit Union Association. I just want to echo that we also participated in the advisory committee and have been very supportive of the process. Really want to commend Neighborhood Partnerships and all the work they have put into bringing us all together. There were a lot of technical issues to discuss, and there will be a lot of technical issues moving forward, and we want to certainly participate in that process, especially with DCBS. I just wanted to finally say that this fits very well with the credit union and credit unions in Oregon, our work in financial education and financial literacy. We work very hard on youth savings accounts and educating our youth that are already members of credit unions on how to save and the importance of saving, and this program really fits well with those goals. So look forward to working with everyone moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Kinnegar.
Oh, question. Thank you. So I take it from your testimony that you would use your CRA dollars to provide support at no fee to
consumers?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We
and
certainly
are the others of you thinking the same thing?
That would be the plan.
That would be the plan, yes.
Credit unions are not required to under CRA. I can give you a long history of why, but we certainly will be participating as a member financial institution.
At no cost to the consumer.
Yes.
And one more question.
Sure.
Thank you. Is there any interest given to these accounts at all, like a savings account?
Those technicalities are in development right now. Yes, it is anticipated these would be interest-bearing accounts. There are discussions that need to take place between DCBS and the financial services communities to determine how that will be, how the rate will be set and determined.
Thank you.
Any other questions? In the back.
They've already been answered. Thank you, Chair. Is there any criteria around if an account sits for a period of time, if an account isn't used, where does it go, what happens to it?
Again, these are details.
Are there fees? You know, okay.
These are details that the bill stipulates need to be technically addressed between DCBS and the participating financial institutions as we refine what the account itself will look like. However, it is anticipated that these would be in the name of the state of Oregon, held for benefit of a participant, and that the mere activities that are performed in establishing the account and perhaps even just automatically posting interest to them on a periodic basis and reporting back to the state, we may be able to get around the escheatment processes.
Okay, I have a follow-up.
Certainly.
Thank you, Chair. So as it relates to our foster children, we have or had the piece of legislation.
The savings accounts.
The savings accounts. Will
Range
this
12 and up, I believe.
Work together with that? What are we going to do with that? I certainly don't want to see. I'm just curious if you've looked at that. Does that play into this? Is this separate from that? Is how will that?
Chair Lively, Vice Chair Hack, that legislation was passed last year, and we all worked very hard on the foster care kids' savings accounts. This, with being newborns, I think it's a separate issue.
Okay,
I think this
true.
Is for the old, the foster care kids, and I can't remember the age of being able to go and set up their own accounts. 12.
So, can I have a follow-up with that, though?
Yeah.
So I guess my follow-up to that is, if we have kids that are in the foster system, because that does happen at birth, will this also be addressed? We wouldn't want any, if we're going to do it, we don't want to leave anybody out.
Chair Lively, Vice Chair Hack, you are asking some great questions that I know all of my members will be asking me, and we have a lot of those very technical details to be worked out during this implementation process.
They need to be included. Thank you.
Representative Hagen.
Chair Lively, thank you. In certain instances when savings accounts, other 529 plans are set up, there's opportunity for the Oregon Health Authority or other folks to attach to some of those funds in the event that they're no longer needed and there was funds that were used. Is there going to be any discussion around protecting these funds in the event of recoupment of payment? I know it gets a little bit into the weeds, so your answer will probably be the same with the rest of them, but I think it would be, the point is, I think it would be prudent to have that discussion as this is developed so we don't have to do amendments a year from now to correct that.
They all agree, evidently.
Yes.
Any other questions of this panel? Thank you very much. We look forward to working with you. So, Quinn Collins and Kenneth Thresher.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, my name is Quinn Collins, and I work with College Dreams in Southern Oregon. I'm also on the steering committee for the Oregon Asset Building Coalition. Since 2009, College Dreams has been fortunate to partner with the Oregon IDA Initiative, working with youth as young as 12 while they save towards their future and build college savings. We've served over 500 youth in this match savings program and have seen the power that college savings and building college-bound identity can have. Several years ago, interest grew internally for how we could leverage that for the more than 1,200 students we serve each year, as not all of the students we serve are enrolled in IDAs. So we began researching children's savings accounts to better understand what would fit the population that we serve, and we quickly found that the account structures that existed were not accessible to the low-income, underrepresented, and first-generation students that we serve. So you've heard a little bit about the design elements, and I just want to echo that those design elements are not only based in research, but are based around feedback we got from communities and focus groups that we did, including focus groups with some of the youth we serve in Southern Oregon. I also want to talk a little bit about the why behind children's savings accounts. The community I grew up in, and now I'm fortunate to serve, is not known for its college-going culture. Kids don't grow up believing that they have anything, may do anything significant, essentially, after high school. They may, in fact, have their dreams discouraged by parents who don't want their kids to have unrealistic expectations. So my job is to change that culture, and children's savings accounts are a really powerful tool to have that opportunity. The importance of building college-bound identity was highlighted really significantly for me by two of the first students I ever worked with at College Dreams. So I met Carolina and Enrique Ruiz when they were in fourth and fifth grade. We enrolled them in College Dreams, and once they turned 12, enrolled them in our match savings program. This last year, we had the opportunity to reflect with them a little bit about what that experience was and having access to a savings vehicle with matching incentives. What they said was, it ignited the flame of possibility of college, that the road to college was going to remain stable and was going to make it possible for us to be successful as students. I strongly feel that the account we have is the foundation we can build upon. And that alone helped me grasp onto the idea that college is possible and that I have this money set aside specifically for college and know that I can reach my goal through that. Today, Enrique is a freshman at Chemeketa Community College, and Carolina just found out she received a full ride to Lewis and Clark. Their experience highlights why we need a universal tool that can reach across our state, ensuring all youth have the opportunity to build higher educational expectations for themselves and see what is possible. So thank you for the opportunity to share about the Oregon Bright Futures Plan and the pathways to opportunity it has the potential to create for youth across our state, and I'd be happy to take any questions that you have.
Thank you very much.
I just came back up to support Quinn in questions, so okay, Chair Lively, let me know when you're
ready. Okay. Chair Lively, community members, my name is Kenneth Thrasher. I'm a retired business person, and I'm on the Oregon Business Council Poverty Task Force. And I'm going to shorten my comments. I've submitted written testimony. But we really do support this as one of our poverty reduction strategies for the Oregon Business Council. We really do believe a culture of savings, financial literacy, and planning for the future is really important for our children and families. These accounts, I think, are part of that strategy that will help from early childhood through the middle years on into college access. Working with those kind of programs like College Possible, this is a great program when we think about our students, that low-income students going to college, which we're preparing, and having this as a form of gap funding after they get their Pell Grants and their scholarship funding. Often there's a gap. This is a really great tool to provide that. My wife and I provide a scholarship to the highest attendance person at College Possible each year. That's a fund that could go into the student that receives that. So there are great ways where I think we can integrate strategies with existing providers and other groups where these accounts can be strategically used to help our students in the future. And, you know, I'm going to personalize it. I went through two divorces and lived with a stepmother through most of my life. She was eighth grade education, worked in a commercial laundry, so we didn't have a lot of money. She made me put one-third of my money in a mason jar. When the jar got full at 10, we went down to the bank and she opened a bank account. And I went down to that bank with my little passbook, and I made deposits, and I watched them post that interest, and it was the best financial literacy class I could ever have received as a young person. So I give my stepmom credit for that. I'm still with that bank 57 years later. So it's really important, and I think two key factors: the majority of jobs in the future are going to require a post-secondary education. This is a great tool to support that. Secondarily, with half of our children being born on Medicaid, if you think about the number of kids that need these kind of accounts and setting the platform of savings, financial literacy, and planning, we couldn't do anything better, I think, to enable them for the future. Thank you for your support.
Thank you very much. Questions now at this point? Representative Kindergarten.
I do. Thank you. So first of all, I just want to say thank you for bringing the idea forward. I have enormous respect for the organizations that have really worked on this, the coalition you've built, for a fellow committee member, for those of you who have testified. I do have some major questions, and the people who brought this forward know that I have some questions about the design, particularly no means testing. I understand the idea of universality to take away any stigma, but I also know that we have really limited budget, and so I'll just state for the record that it'll be very hard for me to vote for anything that is universal, give everyone the same amount at any income level. I feel very strongly about that. It's the lens I bring to everything in the Housing Committee. I have a pretty strong feeling, and I might be alone in that, so just need to put that out there for the record, but I want to put it out there early enough in case there's any amendments that might be considered. 45,000 kids at $25 is $1.25 million. If you did half the kids who are on Medicaid, which is 300% of poverty and below, well above the 200% that was stated in the data, that would save at least $625,000 a year, which is no small change when we're really scrapping by for every single penny. Aside from that, I'm just curious in terms of the model. I want to understand it compared to what the 529, which is invested, and so there's more of a return, and certainly that's higher income people that are accessing that anyway, so I'm not sure that the higher income kids would choose to make much of the $25 that the state of Oregon invested in them when they probably are more likely to do 529. So I just wanted to understand the difference there and who is making use of that currently. I also hope that you would, because I know you're big champions of the Children's IDA account, and if you could just explain a little bit of that to the committee and the use, the things that that is used for, because I love the very flexible design, but how many children are able to make use of that now, and what kind of investment is put in that? So I want to understand this as part of a three-legged stool that I think you're trying to build.
Thank you, Representative Kenny Geyer, Chair Lively. I will attempt to address each of those, and please remind me if I'm missing one of them. Specifically around 529 accounts, they're an excellent product for many families in Oregon. But I will say that one of the key components of this program is choice, and choice for families to select which financial product they want to engage with to participate in the program. Typically, families from low and moderate income families do not enroll in 529s due to specific barriers around lack of deposit options, the inability to engage with them at brick-and-mortar locations, and contributions counting towards asset limits for means-tested programs. So those are some of the barriers that we've seen for why low and moderate income populations don't engage with 529 accounts.
And do you know what the income level is for most of the people that's in 529? What percentage would be at 300% of federal poverty limit versus others? If you don't know now, I'd love to find out, because I would love to see how this program could possibly complement what people are already using out there.
Yeah. And we can definitely follow up with that and get that information back to you. If it were possible, if you wouldn't mind, if I pulled Jill Windsor in to answer the other aspect of that question. Yes, thank you.
Great. So, Representative Kenny Geyer.
You can introduce yourself again.
Yes, Jill Windsor for the Record of Neighborhood Partnerships. The IDA program is a fantastic program that starts engaging as young as 12. So Quinn, actually working in College Dreams, has great experience enrolling children as young as 12. What we're hoping that this can do is really start to engage families much earlier, so it's to start that savings habit well before age of 12. Do you want to talk a little bit about the
use of funds?
Yeah.
So one of the pieces that I've worked heavily on and that I was able to engage with this was around the flexibility of use of funds of education IDAs, which we know are considerable. So with education IDAs, we're able to pay for any form of post-secondary education or training, and we're able to be flexible in uses to meet students where they're at. What we were able to do was take the language from the Oregon IDA initiative and be able to build it into this plan, so that way the funds from these accounts would have that same flexibility in terms of uses.
And IDAs, are you able to be used for more than just education as
yes.
well, right? For children's accounts.
Yeah. Yes, so for individual development accounts in general, they can be used for post-secondary education or training, first-time homeownership, microenterprise, development and a few other smaller asset classes.
Emergency.
Yeah, medical needs. Yeah. Can you say what income level that's for and what percentage of Oregon children who are eligible for it are able to receive, are currently tapping into the IDA program?
So for income eligibility, it is 200% of the below 200% of the poverty level or 80% of area median income and less than $20,000 in net assets, excluding first home, primary vehicle, and up to $60,000 dedicated in a retirement account. In terms of the number of students or youth that are able to access the account compared to the population that would be potentially eligible, I again would be happy to follow up with that data specifically. However, we do know that obviously not a small percentage of youth that are eligible for these accounts are currently accessing that because of the number amount of funds we're able to raise through that tax credit that funds the ID initiative.
Okay. I guess I just have one other question then. So part of what I was thinking about when you were talking about the you were talking about your savings and financial literacy and how you went to the bank, and I remember doing that too. Mine was the Beehive Bank. And I remember my little yellow book with a little beehive on the front of it, and I had to write down every time. And you were talking about the IDA and how you got involved in this with kids from 12 and up, and I was thinking about just wondering about the rationale of doing kids when they're born, in part. I don't know what, if you have any statistics on how many kids by the time they're 12 or 10 or take a number in the first decade of life leave Oregon and what happens to that $25 then. And is there more of an opportunity then to maybe focus more on, you think of outdoor school for all sixth grade kids, you know, a 12-year-old who gets their first deposit, but it comes with a financial literacy that you do in conjunction with Department of Education, and you really, you know, you make a concerted effort of now you're starting to look at college. So I don't know what the thinking is behind zero. I'm thinking about not having leakage with kids who are leaving the state. I'm also thinking about what's the biggest bang for the buck. And how do we get, if you're only dealing with a smaller, could you give more as an incentive in every one of those years, $25 a year for the last 6 years of school, to incentivize them to continue on? So that's where my mind is going as I think about the design elements of your program and wondering how you arrived at this.
So one of the reasons we chose to start at birth was thinking about the multiple access points that families potentially engage with these accounts. So thinking about some of the access points that happen before kindergarten through either well child visits or thinking about engaging and coordinating with Head Start. And then also looking at what some of those points are at which youth tend to either disengage or kind of fall back. And so some of those really critical transition periods, thinking about between fifth and sixth grade, eighth and ninth grade, being able to capture each of those transition points was really important. And so by starting at birth, the rationale was that we'd have more opportunities to engage families with the accounts, and then we'd also be covering all of those really crucial transition periods that youth face.
Any further questions at this point?
I have a comment. Thank you, Representative Chair Lively. One thing I wanted to just bring out in the conversation is there's a significant difference between having money and having wealth. And I think that this is one of the vehicles to address that. Money can be one generation, but wealth is something that you pass on. And I think that when we're talking about like the potential for means testing, I don't want to get sidetracked in thinking that because a family may have an income over $100,000, that is sufficient to address the family conversation about how do you pass that along? How do you pass along the investment in education that needs to be made, as well as the kids' ability to reproduce their parents' success? So we'll have a lively discussion about that, but I think all kids in Oregon, regardless of what their parents have, should be able to build something on their own.
Okay. So. I agree with that. It is why I love the IDA program. It really tries to do both. But I think that both our income and our asset inequality has grown so dramatically over the last 40 years, and we need to be so purposeful and so intentional with every program that we do to really address that, and that is where my concern is coming from.
Okay. Thank you very much. So, committee members, we don't have the paperwork to be able to move these anyway, and so I'm going to close the public hearing, and we will, once we receive the paperwork, that's what our choice is to do, to move them, then we'll have a work session, at which point we can talk about the amendments, and also DCBS, if we've got technical questions from their standpoint, we can ask those questions then, clear it up.
It's scheduled for April 13th.
So it's scheduled for April 13th is the scheduled work session, so hopefully we'll have the paperwork and stuff back then. So I'm going to close the public hearings on House Bill 3314 and 3367. Looks like I'm going to open another public hearing. Huh?
Yeah.
So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3336. Tina, do you want to?
Chair Lively and members of the committee, House Bill 3336 allows employees to create family medical leave savings accounts at a financial institution to pay or reimburse for wages lost due to family medical leave. Fiscal and revenue impact statements have not yet been issued, and there is no amendment.
Okay. Representative Hack, welcome.
Chair Lively and members of the committee, my name is Jody Hack, and I represent House District 19. And today I have the pleasure of bringing to you House Bill 3336, which allows for an individual to create an account with a financial institution and designate the account as a family medical leave savings account to be used to pay or reimburse a qualified beneficiary for wages lost due to family medical leave. House Bill 3336 allows for joint accounts, multiple accounts, and contribution by employer or someone other than the account holder. An individual may jointly own a family medical leave savings account with another person if the joint account holder files a joint income tax return. An account may not have more than one qualified beneficiary at a time. Certain employers in Oregon are required to provide unpaid family leave to their employees under the Oregon Family Leave Act, OFLA, the Oregon Family and Military Family Leave Act, and the Federal Family and Medical Leave Act, FEMLA. Eligible employees may take up to 12 weeks a year and additional time for pregnancy, parental leave, and sick child care leave. House Bill 3336 creates family medical leave savings accounts for employees who qualify to take OFLA and FEMLA. This would allow an individual or a couple to create accounts which can be used to cover wages lost. These funds deposited into the account, as well as the interest and income earned, would not be subject to federal taxes. The legislation would also create a tax credit for a person other than the account holder that contributes to the account. These accounts are voluntary, and this concept is like the retirement savings accounts bill that we passed during the 2015 legislative session. This was put together based on obviously a need for family savings accounts, and again, like I said, it was mirrored after the savings, the retirement savings accounts that we did in the 2015 session. Again, it's voluntary, and I think you'll remember I spoke a little bit to the fact that I can personally relate to folks that had spoken at our previous hearing regarding family leave. Went back to work the third week of having my first child. Couldn't afford to stay home, and my employer wanted me back to work, so took my son and his baby carrier in his swing, and back to work I went. So I know that this is definitely a hot topic and something that we definitely need to take a look at. I believe by making it a voluntary, not a mandatory program, that it opens the door for anybody to participate. Now, I know there are some opposition because it doesn't provide for those that they say are the most needy. It does provide an opportunity for anyone to put into an account, which I think is helpful. I don't think that this is the answer to everything, but I think it's an opportunity for us to begin to have some conversation about what we can do to be helpful. I think by mirroring it to follow after our retirement savings account is smart. It worked, and we did that well in 2015, and I don't know why we can't take a look at that again this time around. Anyway, there's going to be a bunch of other folks that can talk specifically about the piece of legislation as well that helped draft this. Again, it is an opportunity. It's voluntary, not mandatory. So we're going to hear some folks speak on both sides of it. I think it's a good way to start a conversation.
and it's something that I think is important to a lot of people. So with that, we're probably going to hear from some other folks, and I don't know if you have any questions for me, but I'm happy to answer if I can.
Questions for Representative Hack?
Quick question. Is it opt-in or opt-out? Your retirement savings was an opt-out.
No, that's a good question. That's probably a question for LC. I honestly don't know. With it being voluntary.
Yes, I guess it's voluntary.
Yeah, I mean, retirement is technically voluntary. It's an opt-out, but you have to.
Yeah, I think this would be you'd have to just opt in. Yeah, so voluntary. Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hack, for bringing the bill. Certainly. So I'm going to call up Jenny Dressler, Betsy Earl, and Anna Scharf. Okay, Jenny.
Thank you. Chair Lively, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Dressler, and I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We are the state's largest general ag association, representing about 7,000 farming and ranching families in the state of Oregon and over 220 different commodities grown here. Today, we are here to testify in support of House Bill 3336. Our farmers care deeply about their employees, but they have struggled to recently implement some of the new workforce laws that we have put in place over the past couple of years. These laws separate the obligation to pay for the new benefit from the ability to pay for our members, and I think that's probably a very important point for a lot of small businesses in Oregon. It's not that we don't agree with the policy, it's that we literally do not have the ability to pay for some of these. And for farmers in particular, we're subject to the whims of the global market and the domestic commodity markets, and so we don't have that ability to recoup those costs through increasing our prices. These regulations also make it more difficult to attract and retain employees by taking away a benefit that we can offer to our employees and turning it into a right. Again, we aren't against these policies, but we have some workforce availability issues in our sector in particular. We have trouble getting crops out of the ground as it is, and each time we turn one of these benefits into a mandated law, it makes it a little more difficult for our folks to be able to recruit and retain. That's why we're here today to ask for your support of House Bill 3336. We see this as an important tool to give Oregon families an opportunity to save for taking family and medical leave, and then providing a tax benefit through that pre-tax mechanism that you saw in the bill in order to do so. And for those employees that choose to participate in a family leave savings account but do not take that qualified leave, the bill allows those funds to be rolled over into a retirement account or into a college savings account. So that money will be well used regardless to support those families. We also see this bill as flexible to support the financial needs of many of the family farmers that I represent, and it helps them provide that added benefit that I talked previously about. We support the base bill as well in the fact that it aligns with OFLA and FEMLA. The Representative Hack spoke to what those acronyms mean. I won't reiterate for the sake of time. But the employee threshold in OFLA is 25 employees or more for a business, and in FEMLA it's 50 or more. Our understanding is that those thresholds are supposed to indicate or at least are an indicator of the fact that businesses under those thresholds tend to be smaller and have a difficult time implementing some of these benefit programs, and hence there's a threshold so that some businesses do qualify and some don't. We passed the Oregon Sick Time Law in 2015 and applied that to 6 employee or more businesses in Portland and 10 or more outside of Portland, and that's a lower threshold. So that's one of the compliance issues that our folks struggle with. House Bill 3087, which you're probably going to hear about as well today, which is the family leave tax and requirement that's coming forward as well, applies it to one or more employees. And it applies that family leave over OFLA and FEMLA. So for our members, they're looking at the landscape of every law that they have to comply with. And those dissimilar thresholds make it very difficult, especially for our folks who many of them don't have the resources to hire their own HR professional. And it's the spouse who is managing that for the family farm. So that is one of the reasons that we are also very supportive of House Bill 3366. It aligns with current law and does not add to that burden. As a final point, we're very supportive of the tax credit mechanism. A lot of our employees, especially with the way that commodity prices have been, have not seen a lot of revenue. And you'll hear, we have a farmer here today to speak to some of that. But I have one family who last year, their entire family income on their farm, and they have a large seasonal workforce, was less than $30,000. She looked at what House Bill 3087 would cost for that 0.5% of payroll tax, and that would be $7,000 to her family business. So that takes her family's entire income down to $23,000 just to pay for tax, to pay for family leave. And again, it's not that we don't support paid family leave, it's that there's got to be a mechanism that works for both workers and for employers. And we see that as House Bill 3336. So thank you so much for the opportunity to testify, and I'm available to answer any questions.
Thank you, Jenny.
Okay, next.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries and Oregon Business Association. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify before you today on House Bill 3336. AOI represents, in case you, if we have not talked about this before, AOI represents about 1,600 firms across the state, and those companies provide jobs for about 200,000 employees, give or take. The business community has worked hard over the last several years to implement recently passed employment mandates, including, as Jenny mentioned, the sick time and minimum wage bills, but also several other bills that were passed in the last session, particularly 2015, that add layers of regulation and cost onto employers. Although these new laws have been a lot to absorb, employers also understand the conversation going on around all of us right now about how much the opportunity to take paid family leave would help their workers. But to be honest, providing such leave is costly. Different states have implemented paid family leave differently, but most of those programs, honestly, are paid for entirely by employees, and that is why we support House Bill 3336. 3336 gives Oregon families a way to save for family and medical leave with pre-tax dollars and also provides a mechanism for employers to contribute to those savings accounts. Our members work very hard to provide jobs that not only support employees and their families, but also to remain competitive in a global environment. The fact is, the overwhelming majority of our members' competitors come from states that do not require employer-paid family leave, and therefore that's a cost that does not need to be built into our employers' competitors' prices. Add that on top of paid sick leave in another number of other states around us is not part of the statutory scheme. That's one more thing that doesn't have to be built into those competitors' prices. And you start to see a definite uptick in how much our companies have to charge for the same product that other companies and states around them are providing for less. House Bill 3336 bridges the gap between employers' desire to provide a paid family leave benefit for their employees with their need to remain competitive with those companies out of state, and we urge your consideration of the bill for those reasons. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Betsy. Next.
Chair Lively and committee members, my name is Anna Scharf, and I am a family farmer and business owner in Polk County, Oregon. My family owns and operates about 2,500 acres west of Salem, growing 10 different crops. We also provide cleaning services for five other family-owned farms, as well as 10 Oregon seed companies. We have approximately 10 year-round employees, 30 seasonal employees, and every so often a fifth-generation farmer, also known as my son, who's homesick today, probably watching this. Hi, honey. 2 weeks ago, I was here urging you to vote against House Bill 3087, but today I'm very happy to be here in support of House Bill 3336. As I stated when I was here before, I care deeply about my employees. We have one employee who will be celebrating 40 years with us this summer, and I have others that are all related to each other. However, my family business cannot afford another mandate. House Bill 3336 is the solution to that problem, not a mandate. It empowers and incentivizes my employees to plan and save to cover the cost of lost wages when they choose to or need to take FMLA or other leave. It also gives them the freedom and the comfort to use financial institutions that they're already familiar with, rather than creating a new government-mandated fund. As I stated when I was here before as well, many of the tools we used to use to reward and encourage our employees, such as sick time, vacation time, longevity pay, insurance, have been altered to accommodate and afford the mandated changes required for everyone, the peanut butter effect, I call it. House Bill 3336 gives me an optional tool back in my toolbox for relationship building. It offers me a way to voluntarily contribute to my employee's FMLA savings account and at the same time qualify my business for a tax credit. This I see as a win-win for my employees as well as my family farm. Again, I want to say I really do care about my employees, but profit margins in agriculture are extremely slim. Out-of-state competition is fierce and getting worse every day. Federal and state regulations, requirements, and mandates are going to break the backs of agriculture and family farms in this state. I want to recruit and retain being the key word, good employees. They are a valuable part of operating a sustainable family farm, but I need optional tools, not mandates, to accomplish that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
I just have one thing I wanted to add, if I could, if that's okay.
Right ahead.
Thank you, Chair. One of the things that I didn't add that we need to is also the educational piece that part of the bill also talks about, that employers will need to educate so that folks know that this is available. So I appreciate you bringing that up so that we're reaching out to everyone and that they know that the options are there. And I also appreciate the fact that you brought up that you can utilize your financial institution that you're already with, and we're not requiring the state to do that. The other piece is just that the planning ahead and knowing that, you know, if I'm going to have a baby, I have the opportunity to know that I can plan for that and be able to put those pre-tax dollars away. So I just wanted to add those couple of things, the education piece I had forgotten about.
Thank you. Representative Kinnegar.
Yes, I have just a technical question for anyone. it says a non-resident shall be allowed the tax credit under this section. So could you explain that? Like, what's the scenario?
The non-resident... Do you want me to go? I can try. That may be an LC question, but I think my understanding of that is the, so let's say it was my mom that wanted to contribute to my account.
I see, okay.
So my mom could contribute to mine so long as.
And she would get a tax credit
yes.
from the state of Oregon? And she's living in California?
I don't know what the non-resident, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Maybe someone can explain that later.
Get yeah. some clarity.
My understanding on that was that that'd be an LC question, but my understanding on that, the non, was that it didn't have to be the individual person. It could be someone else could contribute in because we'd want to be able to have that option.
Oh, I see. Contributing to the account.
Maybe it just means the funds in the account are still not subject to a tax.
Maybe it could be. We need to ask that question.
Okay. Any other questions of this panel? Okay. Thank you
Thank you very much
for testifying. Next, I'll call up Trish Garner, Kate Newell, and Chris Hewitt.
So I'll go first. Chair Lively, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kate Newhall, and I'm here today representing Family Forward Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in opposition to House Bill 3336. While I will say we appreciate the growing interest in expanding access to paid family and medical leave, we are concerned that this bill will do little to increase access to paid leave in Oregon for the families who actually need it the most. In fact, we believe this proposal will exacerbate the existing inequity in access to paid leave. We do not favor using tax credits as a mechanism to increase access to paid leave because, unlike a paid family and medical leave insurance program, tax credits will not do anything to produce paid leave for low-wage workers who are disproportionately women and people of color and who are the workers who are the least likely to have savings to fall back on to cover an unpaid time away from work. Family leave savings accounts will do little to help those families who don't have the extra resources to save, those who need every single penny to cover their housing, their food, and monthly utilities. We believe an effective paid family and medical leave proposal should cover all workers. It should be affordable, accessible, comprehensive, and inclusive. As you know, Family Forward Oregon has been working with the Time for Oregon Coalition, which is a diverse group of community organizations, labor unions, small businesses, racial justice organizations, public health entities, and advocates for women, seniors, and children to create a paid family and medical leave insurance program here in Oregon. Before we began drafting our proposal this session, we sat down as a coalition to identify a set of core values that the paid family medical leave program would include and that ultimately became the bill that we proposed in House Bill 3087. These shared values guided our drafting and are the values by which we evaluate other paid family medical leave proposals. Core among these values was to ensure that all workers are able to access paid family and medical leave when they or a loved one are facing a serious medical condition or welcoming a new child. That we included an expansive definition of family member that would recognize the diverse family structures and care responsibilities that exist today and include non-traditional families and their chosen families. That paid family and medical leave would be available to all workers, regardless of the size or sector of their employer and whether they work part-time or full-time. We also wanted to ensure that paid family and medical leave would be available without any adverse employment consequences and that workers would be protected against discrimination or retaliation for taking, for needing or taking leave. And we also want to ensure that paid family medical leave provides sufficient income replacement to allow workers the time they need without jeopardizing their ability to afford basic living necessities like housing and food. On several fronts, tax credits in a savings account fail to meet these core values. They will not ensure equal access to paid family and medical leave, nor guaranteed that all workers have access when they need to take this time. And importantly, also doesn't include the employment protection so workers can't be fired or retaliated against when they do have this need. With an individual tax credit, families living paycheck to paycheck will not suddenly be able to afford to make their own contributions to a savings account that they can't do today. This is like asking car owners to set up their own personal fund to pay for repairs and medical expenses if they're in an accident. There's a reason that we structured our proposal as an insurance program. These kinds of savings accounts are an expensive proposition that only the richest among us can afford, even if there is a tax credit for those contributions. Likewise, there's no evidence that providing tax credits for employers will incentivize employer contributions into an employee's account. In fact, there's a long line of employer tax credits failing to work for their intended purpose, like hiring unemployed workers, hiring workers with a disability, or providing child care. These have not proven to be effective incentives and may simply subsidize employers who are already doing the right thing by providing paid family leave to their employees. This will only increase access to disparities in access to paid leave while doing nothing to provide access to the people who work for employers who are unwilling to make those changes voluntarily. There's also no guarantee that without critical employment protections, even if an individual is able to save, that they will actually be able to take the time they need when dealing with their own or a loved one's serious illness or welcoming a new child into the world. We do feel like it's important that every employee in the state be covered by employment protections. We don't think that the size of your employer makes it that you're less likely to have these serious medical conditions or an unexpected emergency arise. Illness doesn't take into account the size of your employer. Last and perhaps most importantly, tax credits aren't free. Ultimately, somebody has to pay for these lost revenues. The average worker will either lose more income to offset the tax credits or will find basic government services that they rely on at risk. In either case, working people are the ones who will pay the price for such tax credits, even if they aren't actually able to benefit from the tax credit themselves. We have serious concerns about asking low-income workers to essentially subsidize the paid leave of higher-income workers. We believe a better approach would be ensuring all workers have access to paid family and medical leave insurance as proposed in House Bill 3087, much like the very effective programs being used in four states and across the world. In fact, in nearly every country but the United States. This will pool small contributions for employers and employees to provide wage replacement when the employee is out on leave. House Bill 3087 also includes the important employment protections so that an employee can't be retaliated against or fired when they need to take time away from work. Only a small fraction of Oregon's workforce will need to take family or medical leave in any given year, but all working families are likely to experience the need for leave at some point during their working lives. A paid family and medical leave insurance program would cover all of Oregon's workforce and would be affordable for both employers and employees. With that, I will conclude my testimony. I do just want to draw your attention to Kaylin Adams' testimony, who is in OLIS. She was going to be here with us today, but unfortunately had an illness and could not attend. With that, I'll answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Kay. Any questions?
For the record, my name is Trish Garner.
There was a question.
Excuse me.
I have a question. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you, Chair Lively. Thank you for your testimony. You mentioned in your testimony that the child care tax credit, which is currently called the Working Family Household Independent Care Tax Credit, that we've spent an awful lot of work on, is a failure. What do you mean?
Chair Lively, Representative Hayden, I wasn't actually referring to that tax credit. I was talking about tax credits for employers to put child care facilities and provide child care for their employers, for their employees, excuse me.
Okay. So would you consider ERDC also a failure?
That's not a tax credit. I was referring more to the tax credits that are intended to incentivize employers to provide child care for their employees.
Okay. Thank you. Our working families' household independent care tax credit, in your opinion, is a good or a bad idea?
I think it's a good idea.
Thank you.
I think families are struggling to afford child care, and we need to help them afford it because it is very expensive and costly.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
All right. For the record, my name is Trish Garner. I'm with the American Association of University Women of Oregon. Chair Lively and Vice Chairs Peluso and Hack. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. AUW of Oregon is committed to promoting the economic, social, and physical well-being of all persons. In order to bring this goal to reality, we worked hard, assuring greater availability and access to benefits and policies that promote work-life balance. It is clear to us that House Bill 3336 is written with genuine compassion and a desire to do what's right by employees and their families. Because so many Oregonians work and are also caregivers for children and spouses, but also for aging parents and grandparents, family and medical leave is a key to achievement in the workplace, for family well-being, and life success. With an aging workplace, this challenge is not going to get any better. Unfortunately, however attractive it might seem, providing tax credits to employers and income tax deductions to employees to fund an employee's family and medical leave savings account will not reach the very people who need the benefits the most. And these are low-wage workers. Although in this example I'm about to give refers to federal taxes, which was the data I was able to receive, given standard deduction and personal deductions, low-income households, owe often no income tax. Only 12% of households in the bottom income quartile will pay any federal income tax in 2017. In these circumstances, an additional income deduction just won't matter. As we know, caregiving responsibilities fall disproportionately on women. Women who are family caregivers are also 2.5 times more likely to live in poverty and 5 times more likely to receive supplemental security income. Low-wage workers are often presented with impossible choices: rent versus food, medical care or going without, paying for child care and going to work or missing work entirely, a paycheck versus education. These low-wage workers are simply not going to be able to afford the luxury of funding family leave with a tax deduction. And even if employees can set aside funds for this account, there is no guarantee they'll be able to actually avail themselves of it. House Bill 3087 presents a better, fairer approach. It establishes a state-administered and paid family and medical leave insurance program where employers and employees make contributions. Employees also can't be fired or retaliated against for actually availing themselves of the leave. We urge you to oppose House Bill 3336, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Lively and members of the committee. For the record, Chris Hewitt here on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today, also in opposition to House Bill 3336. ONA's 15,000 members provide care in every corner of our state, and we have a robust history of advocating for policies that address social determinants of health and enhance patient outcomes in our state, particularly for some of our state's most vulnerable populations. So while we also applaud the effort here today to increase access to paid family medical leave, we also think that any truly effective policy should cover all families while being affordable, accessible, and inclusive of all workers in all workplaces. And to that end, House Bill 3336 falls short of these criteria in proposing tax credits as the foundation of a paid leave system, and also, as you've heard, offering no job protections for those who utilize the benefit. We think this will serve to just further widen our state's current unequal access to paid leave, as only those wealthier individuals and businesses would likely possess the means needed to invest in the savings accounts prescribed in the bill. ONA nurses frequently see lower-income patients whose health conditions adversely suffer after being forced back to work due to economic pressures shortly following the birth of a child or the treatment for a serious illness for themselves or a family member. So offering a tax-advantaged health savings option we think is going to do little to aid everyday working families like these, who often, as you've heard from others here on the panel, already face impossible choices between caring for their loved ones and having to return to work abruptly just to make ends meet and afford basic necessities like housing and putting food on the table. So House Bill 3336, again, as you've heard, provides no robust employment security whatsoever, even for those who may well have the means to save under the program. And we think that undermines the true purpose of actually adopting a worthwhile paid leave system in our state to begin with. Those who might be able to afford it just, you know, they'll be hesitant to take it in all likelihood as a result. Again, a more comprehensive approach to the issue would be a social insurance program as proposed under House Bill 3087. This will pool small contributions from both employers and employees, provide wage replacement for workers while they're out on leave, and does prescribe explicit job protections to prevent any kind of reprisal for those that access the benefit. In contrast, HB 3336 stands as an inadequate proposal that ultimately will not support low-wage Oregonians and excludes large cross-sections of our communities from affording any benefit. Likely, this will result in what we feel will be a negligible effect on improving overall patient outcomes or producing any savings for our healthcare system in our state. So with that, ONA also urges you to oppose HB 3336.
Representative Hayden, please.
Yes, Chair Lively, just as a matter of procedure, at your discretion, I would like to remind folks that we are testifying on a particular bill, and testifying in opposition is the opportunity provided here. We've had other opportunities for other bills to testify, but this, in my opinion, should be limited to the bill at hand. Thank you.
Agreed.
And Representative Hayden, I agree with you. And the first group that spoke also mentioned the previous bill, and I should have at that point said, let's focus on this particular bill. So I apologize for that, but you're absolutely correct.
Thank you.
Is a hearing on 3336. It's not a hearing on 3087 or the merits of that bill. So thank you.
May I also comment?
Sure.
Thank you, Chair. One of the things I just wanted to point out, that this does mirror the retirement savings account. Which majority of, if not all of the groups at the table, as I look back on the 2015 meeting materials, we're all in favor of, and testimony is very similar in that underserved and folks needed retirement savings accounts, and that plan was okay, but this one isn't. So just
the irony of difference.
The
bills.
Irony of difference, I guess.
So we're not going to debate. That's okay.
No, I just would point out that I think there is a much longer period of savings that an individual has to save for retirement than they do to save for some of the, like a birth of a new child or an unexpected illness.
That's fair. That's fair.
Representative Brocksmith, did you have a question?
I did.
Okay.
Thank
right
you,
ahead.
Mr. Chair. And I know that we've just been cautioned with regards to...
So what are you going to do then?
but since Pandora's box has been opened...
we'll have a chance later.
I just have the question I think that's on a lot of people's minds, that if The former mentioned bill didn't exist. Would you have the same testimonial opposition to this one? All of you.
Thank you for the question, Representative. I definitely would have the same concerns. I mean, I think it's I might be stepping out here, but I have similar concerns with any type of, savings account. I think it is very hard for the individuals who are actually trying to help here, who are struggling, living paycheck to paycheck, to put any money away. I guess, you know, in my mind, don't want to tie this to the bill that was there previously. I think one of the underlying issues with that is that higher education has become unaffordable. What is, you know, are we going to be asking people to save themselves for, you know, basic public services? I guess I have issues with. I think that that might not be the right approach.
So,
and we wish to respond.
Not directly referring, of course, to the other bill. I would say that our main objection is really the tax credit deduction strategy. It is just not going to even come close to reaching those individuals who really need the assistance. The other is another possible proposal that might be considered by a legislator at some point, and indeed maybe in this session, would be one where both employers and employees contribute, much as an unemployment insurance program. That really gives everybody an opportunity to join in. This is, tax credit means less money in the budget, and I know, at least I understand, budget issues are somewhat of a concern here. And also the other side of it is what good really is a deduction. Again, I really want to stress, I hear the compassion of someone who wants to provide opportunities for people. It just needs to be provided for all people. Thank you.
If I might share.
I have one more answer that I
want. Am I letting this get out of control or what? What do you think, Representative Brock?
I just wanted to comment to that, just because we actually did look at California has an unemployment, disability unemployment type setup, and we actually did look at that and had some conversation around that, and did look at some possible amendments around that. So those conversations actually we're having. Would love to continue some of that discussion.
And we genuinely appreciate that. We'll continue to discuss and assist however we can. Thank you.
Thanks.
We have a few more people to testify. Representative Brocksmith, please. Go ahead.
Well, I'm the gentleman from the Nurses Association.
Sure, yeah.
And I do have a follow-up.
Chair Lively, Representative Brocksmith. Yeah, I mean, I think ONA would have similar concerns about, regardless of the other conversations that are happening, if we're going to be talking about enacting a robust paid leave system that really is a benefit that all workers, all patients can access, that has the chance to improve health outcomes, we want to be having the right conversation about something that is expansive and comprehensive. And so I think to that end, regardless of other parallel conversations that might be happening or other proposals, which should not be named, we've been told, we think that this proposal, this House Bill 3336, would be inadequate in either case. Mm-hmm. To answer your question.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You have one more follow-up question?
Mm-hmm. I'll wait until we have time at the end. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, Bill Perry, and is Daryl Fuller still here? I didn't think so. I thought I saw him leave. So, Bill Perry, you get the desk all to yourself.
He's not the only one that didn't want to be seen with me in this building.
For the record, Bill Perry, the Oregon Restaurant Lodging Association, Chair Lively, members of the committee, I'm just here to testify in support of 3336. I want to say the last panel said that tax credits, to paraphrase, come at a cost. And, I just want to acknowledge, I think anything you do comes at a cost. Even if you have a mandated program or not, there's going to be a cost. And so that's really kind of the choices that you guys have to make. And I think this is more about the choices that employers and employees have to make with each other. Because there are employees that, if I have 20 employees, some of them are going to want these accounts and some of them aren't. And I think a lot of times we force these benefits on all of our employees, even though they may not use them. And in these accounts, both employers and employees can contribute. So it is both, they can do that. The employer gets to make the choice of what, if that employee wants one of these accounts, they can. And I will say, if you, and I don't know if I'm linking this to other bills, but in this committee, we've had this conversation that you know, it is, you know, paid family leave is important to some people. College is important. Retirement's important. You know, I think one of the previous speakers on this bill said, is there a way that you could carry these over so it encourages them to invest in these types of things that are important to them, but if they don't use them, they can use them for other benefits. But tax credits are important because you're trying to incentivize behavior. That's what tax credits are for. And if you give both the employer and the employee the incentive to basically invest in these types of accounts, it will happen. And even low-wage employees and employers will be able to benefit in these for these accounts if that's what the employee wants to invest in. So we think this is a good choice, and we like it because we want to encourage the employer and the employee to work together what's best for that employee. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Bill? And we're sorry that you could only have to come up by yourself.
Oh, that's okay. Do you want me to testify in 3080?
Maybe you might as well. You're up here. Thanks, Bill. Okay, we have less than 10 minutes left, and I have four people left. Four? Did I count that correct? No, she's already testified. So Sabrina and Matt Swanson.
Chair Lively and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Sabina Urdes. I am a video producer. I live and work in Portland, Oregon. I had my child in my mid-20s when I was overburdened with student loans and credit card debt. On top of that, even though I had been working full-time my entire adult life, I had yet to have an employer offer me benefits or an official salary. So in my case, you know, forget about savings. Even with a pay of $50,000 a year, which is considered middle class, I could barely afford food after I paid off bills, rent, and my debt every month. So when I was pregnant, my employer wasn't big enough to be required to give me unpaid job protected leave, which means that I was essentially at the mercy of my employer. He said that he would think about it and let me know when my pregnancy was nearing the end. This caused me great stress and uncertainty during my pregnancy. I went to work even when I was sick or weak because I was trying to save my sick days for after I gave birth in case I didn't get any paid time off. Without getting paid while I was recovering from childbirth, we would have been homeless because we had no way of paying our rent. A few days before going into labor, my boss told me they would give me 8 weeks of paid time off to recover from childbirth if I signed a document saying that I would return to work 8 weeks instead of 12 weeks postpartum. So I had no choice but to sign it, considering my financial situation and the fact that I would have no job protection without it. Childbirth was rough for me. I ended up in the ER and I almost died. I had to have 4 blood transfusions and be hospitalized in very bad shape. Nonetheless, around 2 weeks postpartum, I was feeling pressured to work from home because my boss signed off on my maternity leave, even though they did not have to. So I started putting in work whenever I could, even prior to my official return after 8 weeks. I ended up with postpartum depression and paralyzing anxiety, which affected both the bonding with my child and my relationship with her father. So even as a working middle-class woman, a paid family leave savings account would not have helped me because I didn't have money to save. Many, many people are in my situation, working hard, paying the rent and bills, and just getting by. While a paid family leave savings account may sound like a good idea for people who make a lot of money, it simply will not work for most of us. And even for those who could afford to save enough money for their own paid family leave, this bill would not give them any job protection. So they would still be in the situation that I was in, at the mercy of my employer. Please do not support House Bill 3336. It is a totally inadequate approach to what is a very important issue for all of us in Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you.
Thank you very much.
Hello, Chair Lively and members of the committee. My name is Matt Swanson. I'm here on behalf of the Service Employees International Union. And I will try to cut down to the things that I think have not been mentioned. We've actually got some well-worn themes here. For our union and the 60,000 members of the Service Employees International Union here in the state of Oregon, the issue of family leave, taking time to protect the time after an important life event like a pregnancy, birth of a child, or a major illness is something that we take very seriously and are actually quite, I wanted to commend Representative Hack for introducing this concept into a pretty broad and robust discussion around an issue that I think we here in Oregon and throughout the United States are grappling with. The part that I really wanted to focus on, I think that we touched on a little, is just that in our view, in addition to some of the other limitations in the approach, is that the actual vehicle for one to draw down resources during time off is, in our opinion, insufficient, especially if you take the case of the average woman. I submitted a study that from the Center on American Progress that talked about some of the limitations with this approach. If you take the average age of a new mother, 26 is the age when they usually give birth. When you think of this approach of a savings account, that's not a lot of time to build up compound interest. And the type of, at the same time, as many young people are facing saving for a first house, paying off college debt, probably credit card debt. I think the folks who are here for the earlier savings account bills can talk about the pretty paltry rate of savings in our country anyways. I mean, just Americans who have a basic savings account or something for an emergency fund, you know, it's pretty low. So when we talk about this as a vehicle, are we going to actually expect this to solve this problem that people have of having some protected time to deal with a major life event? I guess the concern is that it feels probably not. Something, there are other approaches out there, and some of them have been referenced here, but our concern is really that as constructed, it feels like this would not give sufficient cover to those who need the resources at that time to take time off, like the person who just testified here. I appreciate your words. I think that's one of our main concerns, and particularly with new parents. I know that we would also agree with some of the other critiques we've heard of this approach throughout the hearing, but due to the shortness of time, I know there's other folks. So I think I'll conclude by saying the report that we did submit, I think, has some of the best critiques out there about how this approach could be really limiting to what is a large problem out there. But I do appreciate the spirit in which this was brought forward. I think there are ideas out there, and I think we'll stand ready to be involved in the conversations and really seek truly bipartisan solutions. I don't think anyone involved in this process is not willing to make some gains here and try to solve what is a big issue for most working Oregonians.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Oh, now the Representative Hack is returned. I just wanted to thank her for her work on bringing this forward. I think this is a very helpful addition just to continue the conversation around paid family leave. So while there are some limitations that we thought appeared here, this is an important step forward, I think, in moving the conversation. So we do commend you on your approach. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I had another bill. I apologize.
Okay.
And I got exclamation points on my phone to run, so I did.
Okay. Thank you for your testifying. So there's two more people, and we have about 2 minutes left. So Jessica and James, if you have anything that you can offer in a minute apiece, I invite you to the microphone to do that.
Beat them to the mic.
I'll bring you out of the way. Hi, everyone. Chair Lively, members of the committee, my name is Jessica Genentino, and I'll be testifying today on behalf of the 300,000 working Oregonians of the Oregon AFL-CIO. We consider ourselves a voice for all workers in the legislative process, and often we will weigh in on issues that most of our members already have access to. In previous sessions, that's looked like minimum wage, and that's looked like paid sick days. But access to paid family leave, however, is the outlier of these worker protections and is something that only select industries have taken up at the bargaining table. And while we appreciate the genuine interest in expanding access to paid family leave to Oregon's working families, we do not believe that creating a tax credit for a family leave savings account will accomplish that goal in an equitable way. The unspecified tax credit that is created by House Bill 3336, we don't feel will benefit the large swath of low-wage workers, many of which we know are women and women of color that have little access to savings as it is. We also feel like by creating a tax credit to provide essentially a health savings account to workers, we're likely asking those same workers who are attempting to help to foot the bill, either by reducing their income tax returns or finding out or lending them to a situation where they find out that critical state-funded services that they would stand to benefit from are either gone or substantially reduced. Additionally, the other concern that we have with this bill is that there's no access to protected time for a worker to take that leave. Even if a worker has been able to save enough money, that there would be no guarantee that they could take that leave or that their job would be there for them when they return. And we just want to, again, extend our applause for folks taking this up. We know that there's a lot of genuine interest, and we are happy to engage in the conversations as the issues move forward.
Thank you. So, James, you have 3 seconds. No, go ahead. Sorry.
James Barta, Legislative Director of Children First for Oregon. I represent the 860,000 children in the state looking to make a better place. And we appreciate the discussion. We have, well, in the spirit of avoiding, everything's been said, but not everyone has said it. I just want to add that it's more than half of the poor children live in a family with at least one working parent, and so this idea is needed. We don't want to create some sort of free ridership and give tax benefits to someone who's already doing it. We want to create a program that will actually enable people to realize this benefit that we all recognize is important. And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Hudson Hayden, did you have a question?
Very quickly, thank you, Chair Lively, and Mr. Barta, thank you for your presentation. Since it's already been brought up, the working family household dependent care was determined that it was not a failure, yet I would submit that there is a failure in that program because we have not been able to get the funds to those people monthly rather than yearly, since this is an open forum.
You're correct.
Chair Lively, Representative Hayden, it sounds like I should let Representative Kenny Geyer give a promo for her committee coming up. But I look forward to continuing to work with you to make that as an effective tax credit as possible for the families that need it.
Thank you.
Representative Rocksmith.
Thank you. Since we have, the unions here testifying, and I know a lot of them are public employees and not private business that we had testified earlier that would be most affected, I think. And we were talking about the fact that we have a situation where these tax credits are bad and because there's such a shortage. I'm kind of curious, what would the financial impact be if every public employee were to take advantage of this throughout the state, including school districts, counties, like Josephine that just laid off 17 patrol deputies and so forth. What's the financial impact to the public employees across the state with the bill that we're not supposed to talk about versus this one?
That'll be a conversation we'll have when we talk about that bill. We'll have a chance to talk about what the tables are and what the estimated costs are and what the drawdowns will be at the point we talk about that bill. But thank you for your question. Thank you very much for testifying. I'm going to close the public for testifying.